You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
At first glance, a fossa looks like some kind of cat, monkey, or weasel. It has paws with claws like a cat, a long tail like a monkey.
What can they teach us?
And those populations will spring up, and so it's just a whole yin and yang, and study after study, regardless of what top predator it is, whether it's a killer whale or a grizzly bear, lion, have shown that, yeah, taking them out of the ecosystem is not a good thing for them.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. Is that an alien species we're covering this week?
Close.
That is crazy.
Close, Chris. We'll be talking a lot about this very unique species. And I just had to open with a vocalization. One of them, the purr of the fossa or fossa. So we'll talk a lot about that. It's one of several uniqueness about this large carnivore from
Madagascar. People have been begging us to do this for a while, and I think, you know,
thank
you
goodness.
And I kind of hold. I know we hold back some of the cooler ones,
yeah.
We don't want
to show all your cards. I learned that as a podcast host.
Yeah. So we're saving zebra. Like the last podcast is Angie.
Yeah,
zebra.
And then I'll just drop the microphone and walk away.
Walk off into sunset.
yeah.
But. Oh, the fossa, Angie. This one, I remember working with them at the San Antonio Zoo up close, doing target training with them.
Oh, cool. I did not know that.
Them. Oh, yeah. And this is the one animal I would never want to touch. I would never want to see in the wild because even we'll get into their size. They're not the largest predator.
No.
That thing would rip me up. They were scary. They are serious. They are a serious predator.
When I was reading about their nutrition and what they eat, and it's like the fossa eats what the fossa wants to eat. Like,
it's plain
and simple.
Yeah. They're just so unique. And just, you know, like the San Diego Zoo. So I always thought they were like a mix between a cat and a dog. And I didn't know. I mean, I know now. But I didn't know at the time, like, where they fit in.
They're so unique, evolutionary speaking. And normally, yeah, I let you just do all the evolution. But this is one of these weeks, Chris, where I did some deep dives into taxonomy and evolution because it's just so fat. Madagascar. And we'll talk a lot about it. But most people are familiar with this island being so unique. It broke off the eastern coast of southern Africa about 150 million years ago. It's about the size of Texas or France for our European listeners. Mm-hmm. It holds more than 200,000 plant and animal species found nowhere else in the world.
Yep. Super unique.
But we'll touch a lot on their conservation day, which I think we have in other pods when we did the lemur. But Unfortunately, with people arriving more than 2,000 years ago, 90% of the original forests have been destroyed.
Yeah.
So they've already lost several species, and we cannot lose the fossa, which is the fossa, really quick. The fossa is the pronunciation in the US and the UK. However, the fusa is how it's pronounced on Madagascar. And so if you for anybody who works over there doing research and conservation, all the experts, a lot of them will use the terminology fusa. So fusa, fossa, potato, patata.
Yeah, it's, I know. Well, and for the movie Madagascar, for those that have kids or if you just like movies and animation. So that came out years ago and it was pretty funny because all the lemurs would scream, the fusa are coming, the fusa. And I used to laugh thinking, no, it's fossa.
Right.
But you're telling me it is fusa. Mm-hmm. It's just we pronounce it different in the U.S.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But but yeah, it's the largest mammalian carnivore on the island of Madagascar. Mm-hmm. So it has a big ecosystem role. It's found throughout the island. But unfortunately, it's really, really rare. The experts believe that there's probably less than 2,500.
Right.
Yep. And there's still a lot we don't know about them. They're really unique. And they just like, Chris, is it a cat? Is it a bear? Is it a dog?
Well, I found this quote. So San Diego Zoo, this is perfect to describe this animal. At first glance, a fossa looks like some kind of cat, monkey, or weasel. It has paws with claws like a cat, a long tail like a monkey, and round little ears like a weasel. So it's easy to be confused. Where does it fit? And we'll get there. We're going to get there in evolution where it fits in that tree. But, you know, it did look dog-like to an extent, you know?
Yeah, for me, it's more of a cat-like or most like a small cougar for those of us in the United States. Much smaller, but still long. And but then those ears and the nose, yeah, it's definitely – I highly recommend – Chris and I will try to describe it in more detail as we go through the podcast, but – it's definitely one of these creatures you need to YouTube. Chris will put some nice videos on our show notes. Obviously, don't do it if you're driving. But it's really, really unique. And it's not found at a lot of accredited zoos in the United States or even throughout the world. I know San Diego has some. So you can maybe next time you go there, you can maybe get some photos for us. Or we can talk to our buddy Rick Schwartz.
Yeah,
he gets to work with them. But that's so cool that you did target training with them. That's I know John will be my husband will be jealous because they're such a unique species. He loves the cat family or anything in that realm, which they're not, but they are, and we'll talk about that. He's never worked with them before. And
because you know you're doing the scale, you know how you do target training to get weights on them every day and putting the scale in there with the board on top, trying to put the meat to get them to come over and like just trying to shift them all the time. And they just like, you know, even the noises they make are super unique.
Chris, see, you are a mind reader. I mean, I know we're seeing each other on video chat right now too, but I was just going to ask, did you hear some of those crazy, awesome noises?
Not the alien noises, but some of the other noises. And I was like, man, they were just freaky. You know, this is freaky. And they're amazing. They're amazing animals. You're going to learn a lot of fun stuff today.
Yes. And honestly, I must say I've known about the fossa for a long time, but yes, Kristen, for me, I've seen the fossa. I think it was at the National Zoo. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. And I remember thinking like, man, it's not very attractive. But after studying and doing researching the fossa for the past week, I'm in total love. I think they're actually very cool, cute, large carnivores. I really do. I mean, their mixed match body, like you described, really works for them. And I fell in love with their unique taxonomical differences and how they must have diverged from whatever creature they diverged from hundreds of millions of years ago in Madagascar. And it just really makes me more inspired to want to conserve them. And when you think about a big island size of France or Texas that only has potentially between 2,000 and 3,000, IUCN lists them as vulnerable, but I mean, if their numbers don't rebound, they're going to be on their way to extinction really, really fast. And that's just, we can't let that happen. They're super cute.
No.
And really important for the ecosystem and just a fun, large mammalian carnivore.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be an amazing podcast as we dive more into this. Just some things, Angie, you know, to tell the listeners, I know you and I behind the scenes been working hard. We have some really awesome stuff coming in the next few months in this coming year. I think year three is going to be big for us. You know, we've seen phenomenal growth in the last 6 months with the COVID pandemic. You know, thank you to all of our new listeners and then those that have been with us from the beginning.
Yeah, Chris, it's been really fun to watch the growth and of course get a lot of positive responses. Both we get a lot of nice notes and letters to our email account and on Facebook. We really appreciate those. And then looking through some of the listening numbers, the statistics that we get, which Chris and I, if you know us, you know we love numbers and stats. But we have a really big listenership in Lesotho, which is a kingdom within South Africa.
Yeah.
So
they just like suddenly exploded.
Yeah, I don't know if it's one listener and their mom or what, but yeah. I want to give whoever's listening from there, thank you for sharing and enjoying our podcast. Please send us an email or like us on Facebook. I'd love to connect just because it's great to know that we feature Africa a lot, especially South Africa. Yeah. And I'm a big fan. I've never been to Lesotho, but I've been to other parts of South Africa and other parts of Central Africa in general. Mm-hmm. So really cool. It helps inspire me when I get up in the morning to know that we're on the right path and that the people are listening and loving. And so thank you for that. And with that being said too, we had a wonderful review on iTunes, which is very helpful for getting our podcast out there to more listeners to help educate them and want them to conserve animals. But thank you for Kyan Hilger, if I'm pronouncing that right. They say it's the best podcast to listen to when they're driving and they learn something. So this person hopes that we continue for many, many years to come. So I hope so too. So thank you, Kyan Hilger.
Yeah, no, and that leads to, if people don't know, because we haven't really been pushing this too much on social media, is we were nominated again, Angie, top 10 science podcast for 2019-2020. Woohoo! Little podcast.
Yeah, I'm doing my ridiculously looking dance. And guess
who was not nominated this year?
NASA.
They weren't.
Good. No offense. I'm sure it's a brilliant podcast, but
I'm sure. But we got nominated again in the People's Choice Podcast Awards. It's one of the, I guess, the biggest only podcast awards around the world. And we're in the science category once again. So voting is underway. They have like 5,000 podcast listeners. So some of them might be listening to this one or some of our previous podcasts. And it's exciting for us because we put so much, you know, our heart and soul into this podcast. We've been working really hard. And just to get some recognition that, I mean, top 10 science podcasts in the world is insane. That's insane.
Yes, it does. It helps us know we're in the right direction. And regardless, you and I have fun each week doing this too. And the cool people we meet along the way. We've done some really amazing interviews this past month. And I hope that pattern is going to continue. So yeah, we're just making a lot of awesome connections, which is key because as we keep learning this podcast, a repeat pattern is individual movements help, but as a group collectively, that's where the big change is going to be.
Amen.
And so staying in our education network or conservation network is going to be really, really helpful to help protect all animals and then even all the way over to Madagascar with the FASA.
And they need it. They need it. And then just really quick, one last thing, just a thank you to Brett, who emailed us. He wrote that his favorite animal was the Eastern Hellbender, and that's how they found the podcast. And had some good suggestions, Brett. Most of them were ocean animals. We'll get back to the ocean. We just did all of it in July, but there's one on there I definitely want to do soon. So hopefully we'll do that. And then Jackson from the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
So he listens to the podcast in the kitchen every day as they cut up diets. He also had some amazing suggestions.
Yes, I think all of his, I was like, Chris, let's do this one. Let's do that one. Let's do this. Yeah. So thank you, Jackson.
Yeah, we will. So Angie, the FASA, like I said, it's not the largest carnivore in the world, but I'm telling you, it is the most gnarly. There you go. California slang. It is the most gnarly, but it's beautiful. It's a beautiful mishmash of
everything. Yes. There's cats. Yeah. It's like, it's in general has a cat like appearance, with a large blunt nose and forward facing eyes, but then it has these round Mickey Mouse, if you will, ears. It reminds me more of like a weasel. And in general, they're covered in short but thick fur that's red, brown in color, and juveniles have a little bit different shade to their coats. I guess there are some individuals that can be almost black in color, but that's pretty rare. They do have cat-like claws. They're short, curved, and they're able to retract them. However, it's a little bit different strategy than a typical feline, which is important for the taxonomists that are super geniuses that know how to put these animals into different clads and groups and things. And yeah, it's in tail, though, is what really was striking to me. Much different than a typical felid or a cat, in my opinion, because it's really long, but it's really thick. And when we get more into physiology and behavior, we'll talk about how they actually use their tail a lot. And it's really important. That's probably why it evolved to be, I mean, most of its body length, like what? They can be, what, six?
Yeah, so the body... Yeah, so the body length can be up to 31 inches long or 80 centimeters. The tail length is 28 inches long or 70 centimeters. So, yeah, it's as long as their body.
Right.
It's crazy. Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I know.
So really, really impressive.
Then, yeah, and then, you know, the males weigh up to 19 pounds or almost 9 kilograms. Females, 15 pounds, you know, 7 kilograms. So they're not – they are the largest predator on Madagascar. It's correct. Just they're not even leopard size. I mean, they're and I would just say it's shorter than, like you said, like an ocelot or bobcat, but maybe the same body size, you know, just
right.
You know, not quite as big as like, say, a leopard or something.
Oh,
like
not
that,
even. But, yeah. Or cougar or anything like that. No, definitely not. Yeah. But still impressive. That's for sure. And just really beautiful. If you take a screenshot of their face and they have these golden brown, amber colored eyes and just watching them on video this week, the way they move, they're very agile. That does remind me more of like a cat as far as their walking and their stalking. And we'll get to their tree climbing too, which they were definitely designed to spend a lot of time in trees. So just really a unique, fun, knock your socks off predator. Carnivore.
Yeah, so now the next time you see him at the zoo or something, you're gonna realize how lucky you are.
I know. Him. I go back. And that's always been the thing, is I'm a hoof and horn girl, and so I'm always all about seeing those species, right, at the zoo and being in awe.
Just eating.
Yeah, I just like to watch them munch on grass. Like, that's my zen. Yeah, you know, when your therapist or somebody says, go to your happy spot, I'm like, okay, that's me, like, hearing a horse or a zebra chewing. It's just so ridiculous, but I just love it. But my husband, obviously, he's the big cat guy and loves himself carnivores. That's what he prefers to work with. Yep. And so, I mean, I'm sure he stopped in awe and was a little jealous of that zoo having him and him not getting to work with them. But now I know. That's why I do this podcast. I have this newfound appreciation for so many species that I guess I think without knowing all the physiology, I'm such a physiologist at heart now that I just have a whole new appreciation for the different strategies of hunting and eating or flying or swimming. And that's why I love this podcast.
I know. They're amazing. And so when we say they're Madagascar, I mean, they used to range most of it until, and we'll get to it, you know, when humans arrived, but generally the forested regions of Madagascar and generally near the coasts is kind of where I would say that the central region is not where they range. And, you know, now, like you said, Angie, 90% of the forests have degraded. So their habitat has shrunk drastically.
Correct.
Drastically. So, yeah, we'll get there.
Right. And that's when you worry about fragmentation. So, okay, maybe there's 100 up here, but how do they get to the ones that are down south and things like that? And so, yeah, they're typically found throughout Madagascar, but they're very rare. Very rare to actually see one, or for the research scientists that are trying, conservationists are trying to study them and learn more, tagging them and learning more about them. It's still a beautiful miracle almost when they find them and are able to learn more about them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, slipping into why care, I mean, it's easy. They're a predator. They're the top predator.
Yeah.
They are the predator in Madagascar. It's so critical for that healthy ecosystem.
Absolutely. And then as a top predator, we'll talk about all their different diets, but if they are taken out or even just their reduction in general is going to let some of their prey animals become overpopulated, which mm-hmm. those prey animals, a lot of them are either herbivores or prey on even smaller animals that then eat grasses and plants and fruits and things like that. And so then those populations will spring up. And so it's just a whole mm-hmm. yin and yang, and study after study, regardless of what top predator it is, whether it's a killer whale or a grizzly bear or a lion, have shown that, yeah, taking them out of the ecosystem is not a good thing for a lot of the other species in that habitat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And like the wolves in Yellowstone. I mean, we always go back to that one. And then the interview I had with National Geographic, Dr. Enric Sala, which I believe we're going to air before this episode, or it might air after, but I got a new one for us. And that basically is sea otters. So he talks a lot about, he worked at Scripps Institute in La Jolla in San Diego. And he talked about how when sea otters are removed from the ecosystem, sea urchins bloom like crazy
mm-hmm.
and they eat all the kelp. And so then the kelp forests go away and all the animals that depended on that are gone. And you just have a ton of sea urchins everywhere. Nothing keeping the sea urchins in check, where sea otters used to be like one of the major checks for them. So again, taking out these animals, these top predators or key species, you start to see the food webs break down. So that's a fascinating interview. That one was, that was a great one we just did too. Yeah. And so Angie, you know, being the FASA is the top predator. I did go and I think the biggest thing for me this week is how endangered they really are. I know they list them as vulnerable, you know, a downward trend. I mean, 2500.
They used to be endangered though.
Yeah. And just looking at the destruction of Madagascar, I mean, it's just continuing. So I looked up, I found a really interesting paper that was published last year, The Effects of Habitat Alteration and Disturbance by Humans and Exotic Species on FASA.
The dog, in Madagascar's, our favorite. I know.
In Madagascar's deciduous forest. So this was Merson and others that published this in Fauna and Flora International. So we did already cover, they talk a little bit about it in the beginning of the paper, how the forest, like you mentioned, 90% degraded. We talked a lot about that in episode 128, Red Ruff Lemur. If you haven't heard it, go. The lemurs are amazing. But that has just drastically reduced, animal populations there. So they talk about how the FASA, as that apex predator, is so important in keeping not only lemurs in check, but small mammals, other small mammals, reptiles, and birds. Male FASAs, and I don't want to get ahead to if you have this data or not, but they said male FASAs have a home range of up to 50 square kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane. For this isn't a major big lion.
Right.
This is a smaller predator.
They can travel.
This isn't, mm-hmm. Leo the lion. And 50 kilometers squared is huge. That's a huge home range. So obviously they need lots of land. And so not only is habitat loss, but there's also bushmeat hunting, retaliatory killing. Now, mainly for chickens, which is interesting, because that has to do a little bit with, which you're going to talk about, their scent glands. There's a myth out there that they come and just destroy chicken coops and stuff, and they don't. But they're blamed for it, so they're killed for that. And then we're going to talk about exotic species. So
you
the
mean
study was
invasive species.
Well, they call them exotic in the paper, but yeah, invasive. Okay, yeah, I would say you're right. Invasive. That's better for us. Like that's kind of what we've talked about for the last 2.5 years. But exotic, quote unquote,
not
invasive
yeah, not
species.
From where?
Yeah, Madagascar. Yeah. So that was the first objective was to look effects on human and these invasive species. Then wanted to look at, how the landscape, changing landscapes affected them over time. The interesting thing about this paper, and again, this is why we do research and, you know, always keep repeating it to make sure this is true, that they're actually doing okay with habitat disturbance right now.
That's
good.
It's not
having a major, major drastic effect on fossa per se. In the long run, it does.
Of course.
Because in their conclusions, they talk about with reduced lemurs, reduced other birds,
prey,
reptiles, the fossa has nothing to eat. So then they are in trouble. Where the big impact right now is free-ranging cats and dogs.
Yes.
That is having a major impact on fossa.
Yeah.
And that is the long-term decline. Yeah.
Well, Chris, and that leads to this really crazy fact that I learned from one of the foremost fossa, or as he pronounces them, FUSA experts, Dr. Luke Dollar, who's been in and out of Madagascar studying the FUSA for over 20 years. And he's a highly accredited scientist, I think professor. He also works with National Geographic to help promote Madagascar conservation, especially with the FUSA. It's like a really cool guy. He's got tons of YouTube videos out there trying to promote FUSA education and conservation. And he is part of a project that was trying to figure out what to do with the feral dog population in Madagascar, because a lot of the dogs and cats in Madagascar are not pets. They are, they're not necessarily chased out by villagers because they will bark and they're tolerated by villagers, but then a lot of them, but they're not necessarily fed. So they're more feral. And then they have to travel into the forest to look for food. And that happens to then take away prey from the FUSA, and of course potentially could prey on FUSA depending on the size of the animal. He stated that, this is Dr. Luke Dollar, that one dog, and there's a lot of them there, eats up to 1 kilogram every few days. So he said per dog, a kilogram of these super unique, super endangered species are disappearing every few days. And to me, Chris, that visual just made my bone shiver. I did not like that. I mean, I'm 100% a dog person. I love my pet dog. They're not out hunting. They feed, you know, they eat kibble, dog chow. I don't know, some fancy pet food brand. I don't, but this is a totally different. So Dr. Luke Dollar and National Geographic and several other, the Duke Lemur Center are working on sterilizing these feral dogs. So
that was going through my head.
Yeah, like, spaying and neutering them, like, and then so they don't kill them or hurt them or anything. They just want to stop them from reproducing. At, as we all know, cats and I mean, we have a huge problem in the United States and many other countries as far as unwanted pets from people not spaying and neutering their pets. So anyway, so I have to give a big shout out to Dr. Luke Dollar. I do not know him. I would love to talk to him in more detail, as he is the expert, and he is just really, he's just an amazing conservation hero for the FASA or FUSA, and he's been fighting for them for 20 years. And so definitely he's the expert, and he says FUSA, so we should we should probably say FUSA.
Say FUSA, FUSA, FASA. But he is actually the second author on this paper too, by the way. So I looked it up.
I'm telling you, he's the man. He's definitely the FUSA man. I don't know if he's ever been called that before. He may not appreciate that. I don't know.
we should reach out to him, see if we can get him on the pod.
Yeah, awesome. Because it really – and that's one of the reoccurring themes that Chris and I keep learning as we do this podcast and interview these experts, is that, you know, there's really not a one silver bullet shot to protect the FUSA or the lemur, or the red rough lemur for that matter. It takes a lot of different angles and attempts as far as protecting their habitat, educating the local people to not fear them or do any retaliation kills, to not eat them for bushmeat. But then it also takes protecting them from zoonotic diseases, from feral dogs, and from being eaten by them. And
rabies.
Rabies
is a problem.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's many, many angles, but luckily there's these brilliant scientists and conservationists like Dr. Luke Dollar and his team, and obviously National Geographic appreciates him as a brilliant scientist trying to fight for these guys. And that's what gives me hope. And towards the end of the podcast, I'm going to talk about p- p- potential ways that you can help in Madagascar, because I know I was really inspired this week after learning about FASAs and just wanting to help them, and they need help. One article that really struck me, and we've talked about this in the past couple months, is that people do appreciate Madagascar for its crazy hotspot of diversity, and ecotourism has been a huge boon to Madagascar as far as, and they do a lot of great ecotourism there. Of course, do your research if you ever go. But unfortunately, with COVID-19, the world came to a screeching halt, and it's tough on the local that depend, whether it's different lodges and the people that work for the lodges or tour operators or national park guards and things like that. They depend their paycheck being paid pretty much by ecotourism. And so because of that, it's tough over there right now. And a lot of the researchers like Dr. Dollar, I'm not sure if he's there or not. I don't want to speak for him, but the woman that was being interviewed in the article that I read, she hasn't been able to be over there in like 6 months and is very worried about what's happening because the villagers depend on her for some of their income. And I mean, it's not their fault, but if they get hungry enough, they're going to go into the forest and look for bushmeat and things like that. And so it's just another, or they're going to be more upset if one of the animals eats their crops or things like that, or eats their chickens. So COVID-19, besides all of its worldwide devastation, it's not helping a lot of wildlife. No. Although you see these wildlife sightings of kangaroos bouncing down the highway in Sydney, and yes, without people moving around as much, wildlife is getting maybe a little bit more freedom back. But in the same instance, in a lot of areas, without the ecotourism, the animals are in big trouble.
Hurting.
And so,
it's hurting.
And so I have some hopeful suggestions when Madagascar opens back up of ways that we can get our butts there, not only to volunteer, but to potentially help drive ecotourism and get things back up and running as quickly as possible.
Definitely on the bucket list. Like, definitely.
Oh my God, Chris. Yes. Ugh.
Yeah. Top five areas in the world
for sure.
I need to go to. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, something I forgot to mention was there are other predators on Madagascar. I mean, there's the phanaloca, which is the striped civet.
Cool.
There's the narrow-striped mongoose. And then they have now crocodiles there. I saw that. I was like, okay. So I'll go swimming in the rivers in Madagascar. But there are other predators because I was interested, like the fusa. I think we just call them fusa. We're going back and forth.
I know. People are listening are probably like, ah.
Okay. Fusa. I vote.
I like fusa. I think it's fun to say.
Okay. We're going to say fusa.
Halfway through the podcast, Chris and I have made a decision.
There we go. Fusa. There are other predators, but they're smaller. They're much smaller than the fusa.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Now, looking at evolution, this was Angie dorked out too because it's so interesting. And when just looking at the family, so they, like I said, I went back, are they a cat? Are they a dog? I would have thought they were Felidae. They originally were classified as Felidae. Then they were moved to the family of Viverridae, which is civets and genets, which we'll get to one of those. And then finally they were assigned to the group of Eupluridae, which they call them the Malagasy carnivores. So there's about 10 species in there that I'll talk about here in a second.
And weren't they, though, potentially thought to be part of the Herpestidae family, the mongoose?
Yeah. Yeah, weasels and mongoose, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So in the – but there are – it's interesting because, you know, to break down their taxonomy, the order's carnivoria, right, carnivores. Suborder, so this is where it gets a little confusing. Suborder is Feliformia.
Mm-hmm.
So cat-like.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your cats, you have your mongoose, your Viverridae,
civets,
which the binturong, right? Is that, I'm saying that right? Yeah, I see your face.
No, it's like
we gotta do it.
It's like binturong. I don't know
how to say it, but yeah, but. We got to do that
yes,
one.
Yes, and obviously probably need to learn how to pronounce it. But yes, that's...
Yeah, we will.
I think
that's
one of Rick Short's favorites as well.
Is it? Okay, okay. Well,
our buddy from San Diego, yeah.
And then who else is in Feliformia? This little question for you. So we had the cats, the civets, the...
I know this because I studied this week because I was so fascinated. And then when we get to Repro, we're going to have to turn our PG... G-rated listeners probably down because Hyenidae, the hyena.
Yeah, okay, you're right. Okay,
which have a very, very unique external genitalia, some features for both the male and female. So yeah, like just weird stuff going on. Super weird, unique.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the suborder. Then you get to Eupluridae, which is the family, and the 10 known species. So there's two subfamilies. It doesn't really matter. But within the 10 species, you have the fossa. Then you had the giant fossa, which is interesting. So it was about 2 times the size of today's fossa, went extinct, and nobody knows why. It just went extinct, and nobody knows
how
why.
How long
it
ago? Did.
Don't even know that.
Okay. Wow.
I'm thinking humans. I mean, us to be. Because the other largest animal... class biggest ever was found here recently. You got to remember this one. My favorite. It's like my favorite dorky fact that I learned in this podcast. That remember it displaced the moa?
Oh, the bird.
Oh, yeah, the elephant bird.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, the elephant bird. And went extinct in around 1100 AD because of humans.
Sure, yeah, when they came over.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I think... Yeah, I think that the giant fossa had some issues with that. So anyways, very interesting. So you had the fossa, giant fossa, the Malagasy civet, the Phalaenuke. Then you have these just endemic to Madagascar mongoose.
Mm-hmm.
So the ring-tailed mongoose, the broad-striped mongoose, the brown-tailed mongoose, and a few others. So they're just specifically predators on Madagascar. So all of this began, Angie. This was I remember that, you know, going back to the lemur episode, I was so excited about these facts that the lemurs came over to Madagascar on these raft vegetation about 40 to 57 million years ago, around that time. And I go back to the movie Madagascar because the lemurs showed up to this tropical, I don't know how tropical it is, but this paradise, because there was no predators.
Sure.
At the time, it was totally sterile, no competition for food. I could just see him having a lemur party for millions of years.
Lemurs are definitely animals that party. Like, yes, like a Fusa, yes. Not so much. But lemurs,
no.
Those guys party.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like for millions of years, yeah. they had this total paradise. Yeah. Or whatever. But in my mind, sure, you know, who sure. knows? There might have been something there. Who knows? But I'm just in my mind for 20 million years, lemurs are partying on Madagascar, having a great time.
Totally.
All right. So then the Fusa's ancestor arrived again on raft vegetation, they believe, about 24 million years ago. And I think the party was over.
That was. I'm laughing just because the way it is. You're so good. You could write kid books or something, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's but cute. It's yeah. like I have this vision of all of them partying, having a great time, and then this, oh, hi, welcome. And it
honks. Yeah. Them, you know? Yeah, exactly.
So this ancestor led to the family of Eupleuridae. And so now you have the 10 different species. So that's it. That's their evolutionary history. It was interesting.
Yeah. And but they've really evolved for Madagascar and to be yeah. the top predator and to be unique as far as the way, I mean, they're agile on land, they're agile on trees. And the Fusa has these retractable claws, but they're only semi-retractable, so they can extend them but not really bring them all the way in like your domestic cat can. But they also have really flexible ankles that allow them to climb up and down trees head first mm-hmm. and will help them jump from tree to tree. So they're very, very agile and can spend a lot of time in trees. Their long tail that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast – also helps them balance as they're going from tree to tree looking for prey, basically.
Come on. This is okay. Like I said, when I used to work with them, you'd look at them and like, yeah, you'll tear me up. I didn't know this until really this podcast that I knew they could kind of climb, but not climb and jump from branch to branch and chase down lemurs like nobody's business.
Oh, yeah, they're tough.
They're an ambush predator. But sure. We'll get there. But mm-hmm. like those poor lemurs.
I know. Like, we love lemurs. The party's so over. Cute. Party is over. Yeah. And Chris, I don't know if you saw this in San Antonio, but there's reports of Fusas that live under human care. Younger ones have been known to actually swing upside down by their hind feet from knotted ropes. Like just with their feet wow. holding on and these flexible ankles.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
So yeah, they're really well suited for this arboreal activity and hunting. Mm-hmm. And then of course on the ground, they do well in hunting prey that's on the ground. So we didn't mention in the description too, which is I think really important for the visual description, is that they also have whiskers, which are really long. And they're often even mm-hmm. longer than their head, which will help them feed. Whiskers are, researchers keep finding it more and more how sensitive they are. In fact, mm-hmm. in the horse world, in the equine world, I don't do any competitions anymore at this point, but a lot of really progressive riders and researchers in Europe are suggesting that people don't shave horse whiskers because horses – the domestic horse yeah. has whiskers too that grow. And typically mm-hmm. when you're going into a show pen to make them look cleaner and prettier, you shave off because yeah. they have like their whiskers aren't uniform. They're like all no, over, you all know, over, yeah. like my yeah, husband, yeah. when he doesn't shave for a long time. And so bless his heart. But the point remains is that they're really important sensory units. And so they help even horses navigate their area around their face and potentially help them know where something is or where, you know, if this is good grass. And in an animal like the Fusa that hunts both at day and during the night, we'll talk a lot about that in behavior, the whiskers or the vibrissae, as they're also pronounced, mm-hmm. are really, really crucial. And they're super darling in the Fusa.
So, Angie, I forgot to mention their scientific name because we're talking physiology. And the scientific name of the Fusa is Cryptoprocta ferox. Now, the crypto means hidden.
Okay.
Procta is an anatomically part of the body. I'm thinking of if young kids are listening to this, of the rear end. So you can look it up yourself if you want. Cryptoprocta, what procta means in Greek, but it's hidden end part of the animal because you're going to get to it, but they have those glands there, right? Mm-hmm. They're super stinky.
Yes.
They're very stinky.
Well, stinky if you're a human, probably delicious, yeah. sweet sauce perfume if you're a fellow Fusa.
You know what that makes me think of? I don't know why, but I go back to beavers and they have the vanilla That's castor right. beans, right? Like it's the, they use it for vanilla flavoring, their anal glands.
Yes, you may have had beaver anal gland on your cupcake and not even known it. And it was delicious, so who cares?
I know. So the Fusa can live up to 20 years under human care. We don't know in the wild. Like Angie said, they're really adapted to hunt at night. But I think, you know, Angie will get into their behavior. But I think they hunt like day and night, right?
I mean, yes, Chris. And I have a new word of the day that I'm probably not going to pronounce right. They were always thought to be more nocturnal, but as a couple of researchers, probably Dr. Dollar and his team, have been able to spend more time with them, although they're still secretive, new research has shown that they will hunt during the day sometimes. And that basically, I love the summary, that the Fusa may nap during the day or it may hunt during the day. It may nap at nighttime or it may hunt at nighttime. It just depends on its mood, which that made me giggle. And that reminded me of my domestic house cats, right? They do what they want to do and it's not always predictable. But this behavior, Chris, of being active during the day and at nighttime, kind of randomly, if you will, is actually called cathmorality or Mediternality. New word of the day.
That's a big one, yeah.
And in science, that just means an organism that has sporadic, irregular intervals of activity during the day or the night to acquire food. So, because we usually talk about them being either nocturnal or diurnal or crepuscular, active at dusk and dawn. So, new word, cathmorality or mediternality.
Okay.
Unique, as we opened the podcast with, they're weird and I love them.
They are weird. And their diet, like Angie said, it's pretty much whatever they feel like. I mean, birds, pigs, rodents, hedgehog, like this tenrex that live there.
Tenrex.
Wild pigs, tenrex, there you go. And of course, lemurs are their favorite, which is about 50% of their diet. And, you know, they're lemurs, but you know, to catch a lemur, it says lemurs are so fast and maneuverable, but the Fusa is much quicker.
Yeah. Well, they've evolved to be amazing hunters. They have a good sense of sight, smell, and hearing, which are obviously critical if you're going to be a hunter and an ambush predator in trees, for goodness sakes. And what I found interesting is that they're typically solitary. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to breeding and whatnot. But a 2009 study showed that they have been observed doing cooperative hunting, where three males were hunting a really big lemur species called the Sifaka, if I'm saying that right, for up to like over a half an hour, basically. And then once they cooperated in hunting together, they shared the prey, which they think that because this is such a big lemur, that's probably why they needed the cooperative hunting. But typically, they are not found, they're found solitary. They're like cat-like, that they only come together for mating. And so researchers were scratching their heads on this one, and it's not something they see all the time. Like, of course, in wild dogs, we talk about they do a ton of cooperative hunting, and they still blow my mind. Your interview with Dr. Greg Rasmussen, still one of the best interviews ever about wild dogs and their behaviors.
Oh, I love that one.
But I think it goes to show, too, that we're still learning a lot about them. And that although we like to just say, oh, they're nocturnal and, oh, they're solitary, the more studies we do and the more attention we pay to them, we're learning about unique behaviors that are new. In 2009, like that's why all of you young kids out there, go on Madagascar and study these guys, because there's still a lot, I mean, so much to learn. Like when I was going through the literature, it's like, well, we don't know this and we don't know that. So there's still a lot that can be discovered about these super unique carnivores. And but because they are nocturnal, some of the times they can be harder to study. And as Chris mentioned, they move a lot, often 16 miles, 26 kilometers in a day. It just depends on where the food sources are. And They might travel more as food becomes more scarce. So it can be a challenge to study them. But luckily, all these awesome researchers like Dr. Luke Dollar are figuring out tactics to help learn more and protect them. Because that's the whole key about researching their behavior and why I'm so fascinated about behavior is the more we learn when they hunt, how they hunt, when they're mm-hmm. active, when they're mm-hmm. sleeping, how often are they in trees, how often are they on the ground, that can help promote conservation efforts of how much land do they need. Because at this point, right. let's be honest and we got to be real, it's not going to be a free-for-all with land, especially on an island that is only a certain yeah. size and has a lot of people that need a lot of resources from that island. They're going to need yeah. to survive on probably minimal amounts of land. So it is important to know what happens if they are in a smaller home range, what happens when they are fragmented from other fooses during the breeding season. And so obviously you and I are scientists, and so we're more, the more research, the better, right? The problem right, is just right. obviously funding and accessibility. So
especially in conservation.
But they do know how to help find each other during the breeding season and also mark their own territory so they don't run into each other, because they usually don't want to do that. It's not usually aggressive when they do run into each other too much. They know who's top dog, top cat, top dog, top cat, top mongoose, top yeah, top fusa.
Weasel, yeah.
And
yeah.
so they'll typically back down. And to communicate with one another, they, as you mentioned, they have scent glands, these stinky scent glands where they mark rocks, trees, anywhere and everywhere they can find, rubbing either their chest or their tail or anal area where these scent glands or sacs are. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, how they find each other too when it's time to breed. And as far as other communication, we opened with some of the unique sounds.
Yes. Yes.
That they make, but they include purring, a threatening call, gasps, mews, if you will, not cat-like, but almost cat-like, that a lot of these sighs and just, I don't even, how do you describe what we opened with? Like alien-like sounds.
Yes, just
to sum it up.
If I'm doing sound for movies, I'm going to go get
totally,
sounds,
right?
You know?
Yeah, definitely for the next like Star Wars or something. But they're not an extremely vocal creature, but they're an ambush predator, so they're not trying to let everybody know where they're at. A lot of these sounds are actually made during courtship and or breeding. So before we get into courtship and breeding, which is always one of my favorite parts, I do want to talk about their anatomy of their genitalia. So if there are small children listening or something, you might want to fast forward this part. I of course, will always use anatomically correct terms and super fascinating, but it might not be for the G-rated portion of our audience.
Yeah,
but in general, right, for the male, he does have very peculiar external genitalia. In fact, he has a really long penis and the baculum, which is the bone inside the penis, which dogs have and cat-like species have. In fact, it's so long it actually can reach between his four legs, his front legs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, prior to breeding. So, okay. And it's very thick. And then about halfway down the shaft, there's actually a spines. Although the tip is not spiny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what lions, right? Like you always seem that the female gets angry because it hurts.
They do a copulatory tie. So we'll talk about that too.
Yeah.
And so they have that, but even more fascinating, because we know this about the cat-like species, that they have this some spikes on their penis or whatever. But for the female, Chris, this is fascinating. This is why I went down the whole hyena taxonomical relationships, because young female fusas have pseudo penises. So pseudo means fake penis. We know what a penis is. And they basically experience what's called masculinization of the females when they're younger. And very few species do this. The hyena is one of them. So I highly recommend, that's one of our all-time favorite episodes too, really early on, like what, episode 12 or 20 or something like that.
Hyenas.
Talking all about the hyena, and they're just one other really awesomely unique carnivore. Holy macaroni. But in the Fusa, this experience when they are like teenagers or whatever, as they're growing up, they have what's called transient masculinization. So before they reach sexual maturity, the female fossa will develop a spiny clitori that actually mimics the male genitalia. And they think that this is helps protect females from young males trying to hit on them, if you will. But they're not sure. Because as they actually grow older, so after they're like about 2 years old, when they start to reach more sexual maturity, this anatomical feature goes away for the most part. But what struck me as super interesting and why we need more like physiologists like ourselves to work with these conservationists is that at this point, they don't think that the female's hormones, when they're like 1 to 2 years old, they didn't really find high levels of testosterone in them,
okay,
which that seems shocking because in the hyena, yeah, that's what happened. That's the testosterone is very elevated, and that's what helps drive the females to develop kind of these male sexual characteristics. But at this point, the Fusa, and the literature is very limited, but they're not sure what drives it. And then, of course, what stops it when they hit, you know, what I guess maybe estrogen comes on board. I don't know. But what stops it? So it's really, really interesting from an evolutionary point of view. I mean, I love – the more I do this podcast, I'm like, why is this a good tactic, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, they think that it maybe stopped them being harassed, the teenage female Fusas from being harassed by males. But there's no experiment to prove that. That's just a hypothesis. Right. But a very fascinating one as far as the Fusa goes. Super unique.
Crazy anatomy. Yeah, crazy anatomy.
But when the female finally does reach maturity around 2 to 3 years of age – and is ready to breed, she can be kind of choosy, which I appreciate that. I was very selective. It took me, I had to kiss a lot of toes before I found my husband, John. So it's a good thing. Yes. All you young ladies, be very, very picky out there. Be like a Fusa. And so what will happen is male aggression will increase because males kind of have to fight for the female and show off their strength, and they'll do calls and posturing, and they might fight each other, but they're not super aggressive with one another. But yeah, the female will be up in the trees, hanging out, watching the boys bat at each other. And then she'll decide who she likes best based on who wins and who seems to be great. And so once a female Fusa decides she likes this male because he's strong, she will signify that she is ready and selected him by lifting up her tail and her hindquarters, and then moving her external genitalia in and out, kind of what we see in horses. It's called winking, to basically tell the male, okay, here I am. And they will breed. And this is one of the most impressive, in my opinion, and amazing facts out of any breeding that we've talked about on this podcast. Is your seatbelt on, Chris?
Okay. All right, let me put it on. All right.
So the first fact is they often will copulate or breed up in trees. So there's that.
What? Okay, hold on. What?
So that's a little bit interesting, but no.
Okay.
We're going to talk about this for a second. But they then experience the copulatory tie due to the shape of the male genitalia and the female and how they fit together, and they tie. So there's a lock in place. So the period of copulation lasts up to 3 hours.
3 hours?
In a tree.
In a tree. Don't fall. Please don't fall.
I know. It's one of the most – I don't think that's very romantic in my opinion. I mean, I guess I'm an old-fashioned girl. But yeah – bless the female Fusa's heart as well, because she is polyandrous, which means she actually breeds with lots of males. Yeah, okay. Usually more than one. So for during the breeding season, one to two to three. So she's doing that acrobatic act for a while. So when we talk about how good climbers are, they are, how strong, how agile. It's just a visual I can't get out of my head. And it's very, very impressive.
That I would have never. Okay. Yeah,
I know these guys are so guys and girls are so unique and so impressive. And like I said, I had a lot of giggles to myself learning about this stuff. But no, it's really, really cool and really important that, of course, they have trees. And of course, from a conservation point, all jokes aside, is that it's really important for them to find one another. And a female to pick between, you know, many males and then to breed with a couple different males for genetic diversity and things like that. And to have trees available for some of their mating rituals. And and the more we know about them, the more we can help protect them. And with that being said, researchers do know that the breeding or mating will occur in about September, October. And then young, so I don't know if they're cubs or kits. I didn't get that, but the baby fusas are born in the den around December, January, after only a 3-month gestation period. So
that's short,
But they're tiny when they're born. She'll have about 2 to 4 little ones that only weigh 100 grams, and they're super altricial. They're toothless and blind, but they do have a little fur. And they'll stay very close to their mom, and the female will lactate for about 4 to 5 months or so, but the young fusas will stay with its mom until it's anywhere from 1.5 to 2 years old. So, and then they're considered, you know, mostly an adult. But with them being a carnivore species and a specialized arboreal hunter, as we mentioned, it's important that they stay with mom to learn these skill sets of how to hunt and where to hunt and when to hunt. So compared to a lot of cats, like the domestic cat that we're familiar with and things like that, they have a much, much longer life cycle or generation interval. And so they're not going to be able to rebound as quickly, even with conservation efforts that are ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's the battle is just to save whatever forests are left there. You know, it's just, oh God, that's fascinating. Repro.
I thought you would like that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But you get something so unique. You just, you know, in the trees.
And I don't know. I didn't find a study that says it's 100% in the trees, but it can happen. But
they breed in trees.
Yeah. Well, and I like that she kind of sits up on the trees, looking down at the males fighting too. I don't know why. I just
just like, you know, looking at her claws. Yeah.
It's not even like which one of you do I like the best. It's like which one of you do I like first, second, and then third. And then you know, she like places them. So funny.
There's a lot of inappropriate jokes.
But the male, but I also forgot to mention the male, interestingly enough, after they copulate, he'll hang out with her for about an hour or so. Okay. So and I don't, researchers, yeah, they don't necessarily know why. Maybe to make sure that another male doesn't breed her right away, or maybe he is a hopeless romantic that she just, you know, she just tosses him to the side and then gets the next one. I don't know.
Yeah.
But what?
Well, I mean, yeah, they want genetic diversity.
Correct.
So,
correct.
You know. Well, and that, you know, like you were saying earlier, so we know there's 2,500 in the wild left, roughly. And the largest pocket that they estimate is about 400 fusa. So heavily fragmented across Madagascar. So she's, it's like, you know, Bob, Rob, and Todd or something. You know, the same three every year. Oh, you guys are back.
Well, they did mention that she'll often go to the same tree. Like, that's her branch. That's her tree. This is my tree to scope out these fusa boys. Or these fusa males.
Right.
So there's but once again, if that tree's cut down, does that then screw up her reproduction or the courtship behavior of these guys? Yeah. So there's a lot of unanswered questions still.
For sure. That's why we got to get Dr. Luke on. So, yeah, like we said, you know, conservation, vulnerable. They just dealing with a lot, like we said, rabies, losing habitat, which affects their food sources. The lemurs are in trouble too. So, What organizations? I know you mentioned there really wasn't a FUSA one out there, but
yeah. So the big ones, of course, are going to be like National Geographic, World Wildlife Fund, the Duke Lemur Center. Actually, Dr. Luke Dollar, he does a lot of work with the Duke Lemur Center,
which we highlighted,
of course, when we covered red-ruffed lemurs. And so that's a great one because, of course, if they're going to protect the habitat for the lemurs, it's going to protect the FUSAs as well, as kind of trickle-up effect. But in general, so you can check out those organizations. Crystal puts them on the show notes. But I really wanted to actually focus this week on Madagascar and its conservation efforts in general and how our listeners, or Chris and I, could potentially get involved. Because I don't know about you, Chris, but with this pandemic, there's been a lot of cons, horrific cons, unthinkable. Mm-hmm. So far, I've been blessed that my family hasn't been, immediately affected by losing a loved one. But my family's and I have been affected in several other ways, from job losses to just all sorts of things. But the positive note for me personally of the COVID-19 crisis has been some internal inflections and reflections of like what is important and who is important and what do I really need in life. And talking about that with my close friends and family, and that our community is really important. Where you live, how you interact, and your local food source and your local environment, and just in general, wanting to be more not only of the local scene, but of how I can make a difference, how I can impact the world. And I'm not saying if you're a CEO of a big business that you should quit your job and go volunteer in Madagascar. But if you're maybe taking a gap year because your college isn't offering in-person learning, and that's really classes, important because you're like in nursing school or something like that, it might be a good time for reflection to go see what's going on in the world when Madagascar opens up. So on our show notes and maybe through Instagram the next week or two, we're gonna celebrate some of these volunteer opportunities in Madagascar. And the first one I want to highlight is called Volunteer World, which can be found at www.volunteerworld.com. And they have a ton of projects in Madagascar where you can go and learn and help for either a short period of time, like just staycation type volunteer vacation, or for a lot longer if you have more time or more interest. And the other one is Pod Volunteer, which kind of related to podcasts for me, so I like that. That's at www.podvolunteer.org. And they have a lot of conservation projects in Madagascar as well. And so hopefully when everything gets lifted and we can travel back to Madagascar, or basically internationally again, if you're looking for something a little bit out of the box yet helpful, just to kind of see what's going on with not only lemurs, but of course the FUSA and just the people that live in Madagascar that live a lot differently than myself in North America. And of course, a lot of our listeners in Canada and Europe, to be a part of Madagascar and to try to help save it before it's too late. Check out those organizations, be a part of the solution. Of course, share this podcast. Have a debate with your roommate if you're stuck at home about is it a FUSA or a FASA, which one do you like better? And share some cool facts about this amazing cat-like carnivore that's in Madagascar. It's in need, and I just really think we should help save it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And a shout out to our Aussie listeners too. We haven't forgotten you either. You know, we always go back. We're definitely going back to Australia soon.
Oh yeah, love it there.
There's a few thousand down there that love us. So yeah, that's my conservation tip of the week. That was amazing, Angie. I'll just leave it at that because, whatever we can do, it is definitely an ecological hotspot that needs our help. I mean, that's why so many conservation people are rushing to Madagascar because
I get a lot of students that like love animals, and they may not be going into animal behavior or ecology, some of the courses I teach, but they are really interested in building their resume, maybe getting a job at a zoo, maybe getting a job at Fish and Wildlife, maybe getting a job as a conservation scientist. And I always tell them, like, do if you have a summer off or even take a semester off, if you can, you know, wait tables or save your money somehow just to go experience some real life, getting your hands dirty conservation techniques. And it doesn't have to be for one of the big five of animals in Africa, just being around the locals, understanding how international policies and politics work, understanding what it's like to have boots on the ground, understanding how it's hard to trek through a jungle, checking animal camera traps and things like that. Just learning, 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 especially a lot of the younger students that I work with, how mind-opening it will be. And that's, interestingly enough, to thank Dr. Luke Dollar, who I don't know personally. I wish I did. But he actually went to go study lemurs. And then he was tracking this one for a long, long time, the story goes. And then it got gobbled up by a fusa. And he was like, what is that?
My animal.
Yeah, but he's like, whoa. Yes. And then he dug into the research and there was like nothing 20 years ago on them. And he made that one individual, that one experience he had, as definitely positively improved the lives of thousands of fusas and helped protect them. And he's still fighting for them to this day. So those are the experiences. Awesome. As much as like, I'm always like volunteer local and still do that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Or share things on social media from your couch. Like there's so many ways to help. And obviously in this pandemic, you cannot travel abroad right now and go on a, I'm not recommending that. Do not do that. But save your pennies, man. So when things open up, maybe you can. And a lot of these volunteer opportunities are very short lived. They're not, it's not like you have to like move for a year or anything like that. But I always do recommend that to students and some take me up on it. And a lot of them just do it. They'll maybe go to a different state or they'll maybe go to Canada or Mexico. Right. You know, won't necessarily go super exotic. And you don't have to do that. These opportunities, the two websites of Volunteer World and Pod Volunteer that we talked about earlier, it's all over. It's not just Madagascar. Yeah. I just saw the projects in Madagascar and fell in love. So
leave it at that, Angie. Amazing species. Like, wow. You know, as we gear up for, you know, not quite year three, but as we're wrapping up year two of the second year of us doing this podcast, but you know, it's starting to build momentum going into, you know, third year and some exciting stuff coming. And it's just another amazing animal, like amazing animal. Great job. Great job.
And Chris, I know I can speak for both of us in saying that throughout the 2.5 years of doing this podcast, learning, loving, conserving these animals, and then getting to know conservation heroes that are both just our public fans in general, but then of course, really big conservation scientists alike, that we are making strides. And I just want to keep doing that for a long time. And the more...
Oh, yeah.
We got to keep fighting this good fight for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, stay tuned. We'll be back with a new species coming soon. Take care.
Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.